afternoon. I'm opening the Joint Committee on Ways and Means, Subcommittee on Public Safety. It's June 5th, 2017. Public hearing on and possible work session on Senate Bill 360 relating to prison reentry. LFO, please walk us through this bill.
Co-Chair Winters, members of the committee, Senate Bill 360 directs each county to establish a community service exchange program for individuals to perform community service in lieu of payment of delinquent fees or debts or fees for supervision. The local supervising authority may determine whether to participate in the county in the community exchange program or if a community-based organization qualifies for the program. The original staff measure summary and the fiscal impact statement are available on OLIS. The measure was previously heard in the Senate Judiciary Committee. The measure is anticipated to have an indeterminate impact to counties and their community corrections programs. Currently, offenders on parole or post-prison supervision are required to pay a fixed fee to counties that is intended to cover the cost of an offender's supervision. However, those fees can be reduced or modified by the county. Both revenue and expenditures for each county exchange program would be dependent on the number of offenders that were eligible and the amount of time they participated in the program.
We have a couple of individuals who have signed up, Harry Olson and... Yes.
It happens to be my bill, if you don't
mind. Is it happen to be your bill? Would you like to?
I would like to testify.
Can we hear testimony? You want to testify on it?
Don't mind.
Well, your name wouldn't sign up, but yes, you can go around and I'll hear from you.
Since when the legislators?
Thank you.
He signed up on the judicial one.
Thank you, Chair Winters and Chair Stark and members of the committee. I am Senator Lou Frederick, Senate District 22, North and Northeast Portland. I'm here to tell you about Senate Bill 360 that I introduced after hearing the stories of previously incarcerated individuals who are making an honest effort not only to get back on their own feet, but also to reenter society as contributing members. It's probably not news to you that this is a daunting project, but one that we all have a stake in. A popular perception of prison time is that it represents paying one's debt to society. However, there are a number of other debts that a person convicted of a crime might incur. These include, for example, restitution to victims harmed by the crime. This bill isn't about that. This bill is also not about fines imposed as part of sentencing. But there is one class of debt that surprises many: court and supervision fees. Fees may be imposed for court costs, for court-appointed representation, for some costs related to incarceration, for post-release supervision, and there may be other categories. These debts are in suspense during incarceration, but become due and begin accruing interest upon release. The collections clock begins ticking the day they are released. Now, I'm not talking about white-collar criminals here. I'm talking about an individual who comes out without assets, without a job, often without a home. Within 30 days, he or she needs to either pay these debts in their entirety or commit to a payment plan. If they're able to get employment, they may face wage garnishment. They may be referred to private collection firms, and many report contacts at all hours, which may not be legal or an ethical practice, but what are they going to do about it? As the hole gets deeper, the hope required to find and deal with the parts that they can deal with slips away. The hope of making it out of that hole may die. Prison may begin to seem not that bad. So this bill is an attempt to make the light visible at the end of the tunnel. The goal is to create a way for individuals committed to successful reentry to pay this part of their debt in the currency they have, community service. This service would be supervised and meaningful. It would also be contingent on continuing to stay out of trouble. Under this bill, the debt would be reinstated upon any additional conviction within 5 years, even if the service obligation had been completed. That's the whole idea.
Questions?
Good idea.
Thank you, Senator Frederick. Now I will call up the two individuals. I believe it's Harry Olson and Thomas Porch from Phoenix Rising Transition in Multnomah County.
Yes. Hello, everybody. Chair Winters, Chair Stark, and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Harry Robert Olson. I'm the founder of Phoenix Rise in Transition and a leader of the Metropolitan Alliance for Common Good, MACG, in Portland, Oregon. I'm also a certified recovery peer mentor. I am here to urge you to support Senate Bill 360. In this bill, this bill will ease the financial burdens on those coming home from prison and support their aim to make it in the community as successful law-abiding citizens. I lead the mentor project at Phoenix Rising Transitions. I've been working with people coming home from prison for over 25 years. Before that, I was in and out of prison for 15 years. The last time I came home in 1991, I lived with my mom and two small boys, 8 and 10. She gave me room, board, a bus pass, and $5 a week until I got a job. In those days, that was enough. There were no parole fees. But over the years, I have watched as court costs, supervision fees, class costs, and the interest accrued while incarcerated have swelled. These are often so steep that a person's dreams of carving out a new life in the community seem impossible. And unfortunately, some give up and return to crime in prison. Others are able to persevere, but are in a constant state of anxiety about how to meet all their financial needs. The mentees I work with in prison want to leave crime in prison behind. They are highly motivated, and most have done well at getting jobs. They are committed to paying what they owe, especially child support and restitution to victims. But people who have been in prison typically make 40% less than their peers. I'd like to share two stories. Well, one, and my friend Tom will share one, of mentees who couldn't be here today because they happen to be at work. This is Frank's story. I've been out for a couple of years now and have been working since the day I came home. It's a good job, but I hardly make my bills. I'm being garnished for a past fine of over $5,000. My current address is on file at DMV, but somehow no one researched that fact. Instead, they sent notification to an address over 10 years old about my debt, and then, all of a sudden, I'm being garnished for 25% of my wages. That's about $600 per month on top of the $363 in back child support. Now that I'm already in garnishment, I'm told there is no recourse. I don't mind paying my debts, but how about a little less trauma to my finances here? This Senate bill would help me just to make it in a somewhat comfortable fashion. It would at least make a life of crime seem a little less appealing. Thank you for your time.
Chair Winters, Chair Stark, and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Thomas Porch. I'd like to share the experience of my housemate, Gary. So this is Gary's story. I was released from prison on March 1st, 2013. Reentering society is challenging. One of my first welcome home messages was that I would have to pay $7,960 before I can get my driver's license back, because somehow the county courts were unable to locate me when I was sent to prison. My $775 fine was sent to collections for 5 years. I had to work without being able to drive for well over a year until that was paid off, all the while having to pay my monthly supervision fees for the privilege of being on post-prison supervision, which at times prevented me from working on the north side of the Columbia River. Last year, I was released from post-prison supervision. I paid a total of $1,260 in supervision fees alone. I've also paid nearly $1,100 to Marion County, as well as over $10,000 to Lane County.
In the calendar year of 2016, I paid $1,327 to wrap up the last of my known fines owed to county courts. Any opinions or options for working off monies that may be able or available to people coming home from prison are a good idea. Often, prisoners are unable to pay the steep fines and fees required of them by courts and supervisory agencies. I know far too many people who, in hopeless despair, turned again to crime and drugs and were again incarcerated at the expense of taxpayers. I'm just one voice, but I employ decision makers to support Senate Bill 360 and approve alternatives to monetary payments of fines and fees. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Questions or comments?
Thank you both,
Mr. Olson and Mr. Porch, for coming and sharing your testimony with us.
Certainly. Thank you.
Thank you.
I hope it was helpful.
Yeah. Thank you.
I opened a work session.
Co-Chair Winters, members of the committee, we have no amendments proposed, so we are ready to proceed if the committee is ready.
Co-Chair Stark.
All right. Co-Chair Winters, I move Senate Bill 360 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Co-Chair Stark moves Senate Bill 360 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Are there any objections? Hearing none. Frederick?
Yes.
Sanchez?
Thank you.
Frederick to the full and Sanchez to the House floor. I'm opening up the Senate Bill 896 with a hearing and work session on relating to criminal appeals. Do we have anyone signed up to testify on this one?
Chair Winters, members of the committee, Senate Bill 896 amends and repeals a number of statutes related to appeals in criminal cases and attempts to clarify which trial court decisions are appealable by both the defendant and the state. The measure is effective January 1, 2018. The original staff measure summary and the fiscal impact statement are available on OLIS. This measure previously had hearings in the Senate Judiciary Committee. The measure is anticipated to have an indeterminate impact to the Department of Justice. The department notes that because the measure provides more opportunity to appeal misdemeanor cases, there is likely to have some impact on the Appellate Division's Defense of Criminal Convictions program. However, the number of increases is unknown at this time. If the number of appeals increases beyond the department's current capacity, DOJ may need to return to the legislature for additional resources or limitation. The Judicial Department and Public Defense Services Commission anticipate a modest increase in appealed cases, but also a reduction in workload related to the measure's clarification in determining appealability in criminal cases.
I note that there are three here from the Oregon Law Commission. Do all three of you want to come up at the same time? That's Tyler Skidmore, Laurel Hansel, and Jim Nash. And I see, Lane, are you?
Thank you, Madam Chair. No, I am just here.
Okay. Either one that wants to start first.
All right. Thank you, Chair Winters, Co-Chair Stark, members of the committee. My name is Tyler Skidmore, and I am about to enter my third year of law school at Willamette University's College of Law. And I am also a former extern, now current law clerk at the Oregon Law Commission. For those of you who might not know, the commission was created in 1997 by the Oregon Legislative Assembly to conduct a continuous program of law reform within the state. One of the ways that we've sought to fulfill our purpose this year is by bringing you Senate Bill 896, which clarifies and simplifies the criminal appeals process in Oregon. This bill is the product of a work group that was chaired by Commissioner and Multnomah County Circuit Court Judge Stephen Bouchon, who would have been here today if not for being in a trial, as well as included representation from all of the major players in the Oregon appellate criminal justice system. So with that, I will turn it over to Deputy Director Laura Hansel, who will talk more about the project. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Winters, Chair Stark, members of the committee, my name is Laura Hansel, and I'm the Deputy Director of the Oregon Law Commission. So I just want to tell you a little bit more about the specific project. It's such a good example of the kind of work the commission does. And so this project came to us from Appellate Commissioner Jim Nass in 2015. And appeals in the criminal realm are extraordinarily complicated. It's very different than the civil realm. And over time, Oregon law has become increasingly unclear with respect to jurisdictional issues in criminal cases. And this has caused a lot of really important, valuable resources to be spent litigating, for instance, whether a matter is appealable versus reviewable, and without ever really even getting to the merits of a case. And so with this being a problem for so many years, Appellate Commissioner Nass had identified that reorganization of the entire Chapter 138 was really necessary. There hadn't been a total overhaul. There had been some ad hoc changes, which actually kind of added to the confusion. At the same time, this allows us an opportunity to codify existing important case law, which better helps especially pro se litigants. And at the same time, we're striving to streamline and clarify the law while also modernizing some of the older statutory provisions. So this work group, they met 24 times over the course of a year. It was about 60 hours of work put in, but that was only in meeting times. This specific work group, as you can see by the very comprehensive legislative report that includes two appendices, because we did not think one was enough, a lot of work has gone into this. I'm really proud of the project, the product before you, and it's gone with a lot of effort. Again, many of the important players in the appeal systems were at the table with us, and I mean, we had placed a value on this work group at about $200,000 of effort that has gone into this. And the legislative report is as comprehensive as it is because we wanted to be able to have practitioners and pro se litigants use it to their benefit after, should this become law, January 1st, 2018, to better understand the changes that we have made. And so what we did was we researched many of the side issues that came up, and that's why there's several memoranda included in the appendices, because we wanted folks to be able to find what other issues we did look at for each decision we made. And so a lot of great work went into this. Special thanks to Appellate Commissioner Jim Nass, to the chair of the work group, Judge Stephen Bishong, and especially to our legislative counsel, Jessica Minifi, who spent hours and hours of time drafting. But what this does is this, the final product clarifies the law. It will save resources not to be litigating the same issues, but getting to the merits of a case. It'll lead to fairer outcomes, people being able to make better informed decisions of what the outcome of a case might be. And Appellate Commissioner Nass, with that, will tell you more about the substance.
Thank you, Laura. Co-Chair Stark, Co-Chair Winters and Stark, my name is Jim Nass. I serve as the appellate commissioner for the Oregon Court of Appeals. There are some parts of ORS Chapter 138 dealing with appeals in criminal cases that date all the way back to adoption of the DD Code in 1864, and those provisions have even survived adoption of a new Article 7 governing the judicial branch in this state in 1920. And as Laura alluded to, whereas Chapter 138 has been appealed many times over the years, and despite everyone's best efforts to avoid ambiguities and inconsistencies, it has become really obvious that there are some. I identified 11 cases that one of the appellate courts decided in the between 2011 and 2015 that devoted 132 pages of appellate opinions to discussing appealability and reviewability. So I said, well, why should we care? Isn't that what judges do, decide cases? What strikes me, though, is that if you look at all of the players, the Office of Public Defense Services, the Office of the Attorney General, through the Solicitor General's Office, and the judges and the law clerks and staff, all tax-supported institutions. So that means a very large amount of public resources are going into analyzing and studying and briefing what are really the basic rules of the road. And my view is that the rules of the road ought to be very, very clear, that one should not need to engage in hours and hours of research to determine what can either the defendant or the state appeal, and what issues can the court review and decide. So one of the primary purposes of this work group, as Laura said, was to look at the statutes as they're written now, look at the case law, and compile in more or less one place what are all the trial court decisions that a defendant can appeal. You will find those in Section 4 of the bill. What are all the decisions that the state can appeal? You'll find those in Section 5. On a defendant's appeal, what decisions can the court review? Section 13 of the bill. And on a state's appeal, what decisions can the court review? Section 14 of the bill. Under current law, you may be looking at five or six sections of the law just to figure out each one of those. So I am really proud of the work of the work group and being able to compile these disparate rules and principles into section by section part of what will be ORS Chapter 138. For the most part, our intent was not to change the law. We simply wanted to make a clearer statement of what the current law is. As was mentioned in the staff summary, one of the changes that we did make, though, was in the scope of a review on appeal from a conviction of a misdemeanor. Under current law, one can only challenge the sentence if it exceeds the maximum allowed by law or if the argument is that it is unconstitutionally cruel and unusual. The work group made the decision to make the standard of review for sentences and misdemeanors the same as it is in felonies cases, that is, whether the judge failed to impose the sentence required by law. As was alluded to, it could lead to an increase in the number of cases, but it's not likely for this reason. The maximum sentence for a Class A misdemeanor is 1 year. Unfortunately, or for better or for worse, it usually takes about 2 years to get an appeal fully briefed and to the judges. Well, those cases usually become moot. There is a statute that allows the court to decide otherwise moot cases if they are capable of repetition yet evading review. So in some circumstances, the court may proceed to decide an otherwise moot case, but only upon a showing that the case raises some local or some issue of law that is really worthy of the court's time. So I think though that is the primary fiscal impact, as the staff summary alluded to, and we certainly would not have advocated for making a change in the law if we thought it would substantially increase the court's workload.
Question: when you had that discussion about increasing the court's workload, did you also consider the workload increase in the district attorney's workload?
We had a district attorney representative on the work group, and frankly, this was one of the contentious issues that the representatives of the district attorney's office, defense bar, and then the Office of Public Defense Services and Solicitor General's office met and discussed and worked their way through. I was not a party to that, but the representation at the end of the day was that they all could live with this, that the changes would not significantly impact the trial court, because mostly we're talking about, at most, sentencing issues, and if it went back to the trial court, at most they'd be holding a resentencing hearing, not a new trial. And even then, in most instances, as I said, technically the issue is moot, and what the purpose of deciding the case is to decide some policy issue or interpretation of the statute that's of benefit to the bar.
Chair Winters, Chair Stark, if I may, I think it's really important to note with respect to the fiscal that both OPTS and the Judicial Department found that there was neutral impact. And the reason for that was that there is going to be an offsetting with a decrease in litigation with respect to what is appealable versus reviewable. Talking about the resources that were formerly spent in that area and that we have fixed that. So as you see in the fiscal statement that Mr. Turbington read, both OPDS and the Judicial Department found a neutral impact because it would be offset there. And my understanding is that DOJ, of course, because they're reacting to OPDS, and
I'm just
sure they
would like to have for the record so that, neither the defense nor the DA nor someone comes to us later and have to come to the, whether it's to the full legislative body or to the emergency board stating caseload increases.
Mm-hmm.
Just for the record.
And we took that into very special consideration, of course, yes.
Any additional questions? I do have Mr. Knott is here. If you completed your testimony.
Absolutely.
Mr. Knott.
And thank you, Chair Winters, Chair Stark. For the record, my name is Aaron Knott. I'm the Legislative Director for the Oregon Attorney General of the Department of Justice, here to help contextualize the fiscal on Senate Bill 896. Though really, I think the statement made thus far is accurate. So we did place an indeterminate fiscal on this bill, and those of you that were present for that portion of our presentation in phase two, we did highlight this as a legislative proposal that impacted the Department of Justice. But I think the characterization of how that impact would play out has been fair. So this bill makes a lot of modifications to the world of criminal appeals, and they're overdue. I mean, it simplifies a process that is unnecessarily complex, and a tremendous amount of work has gone into this bill. It also, as previously mentioned, has the effect of expanding a remedy that is available for felonies to misdemeanors. As previously mentioned, misdemeanors currently are only challengeable if they exceed the maximum penalty allowable under law or they're facially unconstitutional for being cruel and unusual, whereas for felonies, you can challenge for a broader array of reasons. Now, because we have a delay of 2 years in the time that we turn around a misdemeanor appeal, most of those will be mooted out because the maximum possible penalty for a misdemeanor is 365 days. So by the time it gets around to being heard, whatever the issue is, no longer applies. We'd be in agreement with the previous panel that that is likely to sweep out the overwhelming majority of the misdemeanors, unless they present a very particular legal issue that needs to be resolved by the court. There's some larger interest at play. The reason we put an indeterminate fiscal on it, however, is that we have no real control over those decisions. That's going to be made by other parties. OPDS elects to proceed with a case or not. We are going to be in a reactive position. We've had very good conversations with OPDS about how they plan to apply this bill if it passes. And going off of that representation, we don't anticipate that you'll be giving us any money now or in the future. But because we don't control that pipeline, we felt like it was important to be part of the legislative record that there could theoretically be a fiscal here if a lot of pieces fall into place that shouldn't.
Mr. Knott, I guess given that OPD, they're not here weighing in as testimony on this, that it would have been helpful since they also, receive funding from this body as well as to what their strategies or what they see you know, as far as caseload increase, decreases, or what have you. And I understand that the law center is coming up, but it would have been helpful if they were here to provide their testimony.
Chair Winters and Chair Stark, OPDS does have representatives here that would probably be able to.
That would be nice if they come and would put on the record.
Yes.
Co-Chair Winters, Co-Chair Stark, Ernest Lannett. I'm a chief defender of the appellate section, criminal appellate section of the appellate division of the Office of Public Defense Services. I think that Commissioner Nass has represented what has gone on in the process and where we ended up. As far as how this will have an impact, I know that in looking at my attorneys and what our costs are driven by is the time that they spend litigating issues. And to see the amount of time that was devoted to litigating these issues regarding reviewability and appealability was quite immense compared to getting to what would be the merits of the case, which are generally more straightforward and takes a lot less time. So assuming that that plays out the same way, we may see a slight increased number of appeals, but we don't expect it will have an impact on our workload.
Thank you. Always like everything for the record.
Of course. Thank you.
Thank you.
John.
Co-Chair Winters, member of the committee, we have no proposed amendments for this bill.
Co-Chair Winters, I move Senate Bill 896 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Co-Chair Stark moves Senate Bill 896 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Are there any discussions? Objection? Hearing none. Can I get Senator Steiner Hayward to take the full? And can I have Representative Jeff Barker to do it to the House floor? And I will have Floyd carry it on.
Say, how about Senator Przanski carries it?
You can't tell me how to run my.
No, I was going to offer a hope. I wasn't telling you. I was going to request. I was making a request. I was not telling. I was
on
requesting.
The Senate floor.
Good Lord. I didn't want this. I just didn't want to screw this up. I figured he knew the bill better than I did.
Well, we can't get him to the full.
I know. That's what I'm saying. I'll do it in full, but I want him to do it in good.
There you go.
You should trust me more at this point. I'm well trained.
Kids.
It's the Senate.
Jeez.
We've got another bill. We've got the opening up the public hearing on House Bill. I did.
Okay.
Make certain I close Senate Bill 896 and opening up public hearing on House Bill 3067A relating to family supports. And we have Brent DeMoe from Polk County and Natalie Lucy from Polk County. And I know I saw, oh, I guess he's not speaking. I'm gonna try to get through by then. Yes, please.
Chair Winters, members of the committee, House Bill 3067 appropriates $200,000 of general fund to the Department of Administrative Services for the 2017-19 biennium to distribute to Marion and Polk counties to implement court care pilot programs. The bill defines court care program to mean a program to provide child care and serves as a clearinghouse for information and resource referrals for individuals and families with court-related business in or near a county courthouse. The bill requires Marion and Polk counties to report on the progress of the court care pilot programs to the legislature by September 15, 2019.
Good afternoon, Chairs Winters and Stark and members of the committee. My name is Brent DeMoe. I'm the director of the Family and Community Outreach Department in Polk County. I'm really happy to be here to have an opportunity to talk about the Court Care Project and express our support for House Bill 3067. So first, just a little bit of background. Last fall, a coalition of community partners, including Marion and Polk County District Attorney's Offices, the Victim Assistance Programs in both counties, the CASA programs in both counties, the Department of Human Services, local judges, lawyers, bar associations, early learning educators, and the public in general, we came together to establish this concept of court care in both Polk and Marion County. We started out by doing our research, and we found out that in the 36 counties in Oregon, only Multnomah County had an established court care program. We have been in communication with them and have learned the ins and outs of how to start a program. The director from Multnomah County's program is here today, and she's going to speak in a few minutes about their 16-plus years of success. We have also researched and contacted other states and learned how they implemented their court care program. The next thing we did is we collected data. In both Marion and Polk County, the Victim Assistance Program collected data for the past 6 months. And what we found out is that nearly 90% of all families with children indicated that they would have used and benefited from court care had it been available. This afternoon, you'll have a chance to hear from the county's Victim Assistance Program. That's Natalie over here. And she works every day assisting families in navigating this sometimes difficult system. We also have the Honorable Judge David Leith here, and you can hear from a judge perspective on how needed this program is. So we did our research, and we definitely established the need. So the next thing we did is we identified quality early learning professionals to provide this care. In Polk County, that care is going to be provided by Family Building Blocks, and I know Patrice Altenhoffen is in the room as the Executive Director of Family Building Blocks, should there be any questions. The location in Polk County will actually only be 2 blocks away from the courthouse. In Marion County, the early learning provider will be the Family YMCA, and that facility is only 1 block from the courthouse. Both of these programs are licensed by the state and are high-quality early learning programs. So because we've laid this foundation prior to coming to you today, we are quite literally turnkey ready with just a small jumpstart of funding from the legislature. As LFO staff indicated, our specific ask is $200,000 for the biennium, and that funding will be evenly split between both programs. 100% of that funding will go to the programs to cover the staffing costs. Local efforts have already raised over $25,000 in cash, and the in-kind contributions are much more than that. So during this 2-year pilot program, both sites are going to collect extensive data to provide a path for other counties to duplicate this program in the future. More importantly, our coalition has researched funding mechanisms in several other states. We're prepared to come back to the legislature next session, if you'll have us, to offer solutions to pay for court care statewide without taking money from existing programs or the general fund. We have also heard from several other counties who are interested in starting their own court care program, and they're waiting for us to do this pilot to see how it goes. One other component of our court care pilot will be the ability to connect families to much-needed resources and referrals. In Polk County, this court care facility is literally across the hall from our community resource center. This resource center houses over 5 different nonprofit agencies and almost all of the county services in one location. In Marion County, the YMCA will be able to make referrals to community partners and also keep a stock of brochures and other resource information to provide referrals to court care users. So thank you for the opportunity to speak about this much-needed program. I'm happy to answer questions now, or if it's all right with you guys, if the other people speak first, and if you have any questions at the very end, we can come back to me.
I'm going to ask, because I know that the House members are going to have to go to the floor shortly, so I'm going to ask that you keep your comments succinct and short so that they can hear all the testimony before they have to go to the floor. So with that, Natalie.
All right. Co-Chair Stark and Winters and members of the committee. My name is Natalie Lucy. I'm a person crime advocate for Polk County District Attorney's Office. As an advocate, I provide support through the prosecution of a case for victims of child abuse, stalking, elder abuse, sexual assault, domestic violence, and homicide. I also provide services to victims of other types of violent, traumatic crimes. My goal as an advocate is to provide and arrange for services to meet the material, emotional, and informational needs experienced by victims, thereby allowing for faster and more complete recovery from the effects of crime. Daily, I attend court proceedings and meet with victims of violent and traumatic crimes. These victims walk in my door with a wide range of emotions, many questions, and oftentimes their children. The conversations I have with victims about trauma, anxiety, fear, and rape are not ones that should be heard by little ears. Children are smart and perceptive. They know when mom is sad, and they know when something is wrong. Subjecting these children to listen to those types of conversations is not something I like to do. Therefore, when a child is present, I try very hard to control the conversation and make it as child-appropriate as I can. That, in turn, makes it difficult for me to be an effective advocate. In my personal experience of advocacy, I have witnessed children comfort their parents, including a 3-year-old that walked up to her mother and laid a hand on her while she sobbed. I have been in a courtroom watching children hang on to every word that their parent is saying about the offender and the offense. I have held a baby for a mother so that she could attend the trial regarding the death of her older child. I am often the only support person for these victims, offering them not only emotional support, but child support as well. Our program would greatly benefit from court care so that we can more effectively provide and arrange for services to meet the needs of these victims. More importantly, the victims we serve and their children need court care. Parents need a safe place they can take their children while they deal with their court business for a faster and more complete recovery so that they can in turn work on being the healthy parent that those children need. And so for those reasons, I too encourage you to pass the bill, 3067. Thank you for listening.
Thank you. Judge David Light and Michelle Ward.
Chair Winters, Chair Stark, members of the committee. My name is David Leith. I'm a state court circuit judge. I serve in the district that encompasses Marion County. I'm speaking today in my individual capacity, though, and I will be mindful of Chair Winters' admonition to be brief. Every circuit judge in Oregon, I think, has had the experience of having a usually self-represented litigant show up for a court proceeding with children in tow. And often the proceedings are ones that are wholly inappropriate for a child's ears. The proceedings sometimes involve allegations of one parent abusing the other parent. Sometimes the case is about, it's an eviction case where the family is on the brink of homelessness and parents are trying to argue in support of maintaining their home. Emotions obviously run high in those and other types of cases, and the children are predictably traumatized by having to hear the testimony. The parents don't subject their children to that because they don't understand or don't care. They do it because they simply don't have a better option, and the point of HB 3067 is to provide a better option, to allow parents who do care to have a place where they can have accessible child care while they go and litigate these adult issues where with the children protected, prevented from being harmed by the experience of hearing the testimony. I do personally support HB 3067. I hope that you pass it, and that I hope it passes in both chambers as well. Thank you.
Good afternoon. Co-Chair Winters and Co-Chair Stark. I had the privilege, my name is Michelle Ward, and I'm with Volunteers of America, and I had the privilege to open the court care program in the Multnomah County Courthouse over 16 years ago. And I will also be brief. I'm just going to tell you that the program works. We've served over 15,000 children. We've given them a safe space and an environment that parents can also seek out resources and support. 95% of our families reported that they had no safe alternate child care for their children. The impact the service has is life-changing. A mother who used our services had called the crisis line the night before. After hearing that we had this program available, she finally obtained her restraining order, which she'd been putting off because of fear of leaving her children. She came back after securing her restraining order, and she told us that we literally saved her life. So it provides access to not only the families, but also the access to the justice system for all through the judges, the lawyers. It just makes it very convenient for everyone involved. And so this
Ms. Ward, how are you funded?
So the legal community has embraced us. We receive $100,000 a year from the Multnomah Bar Association, which is part of the lawyers, judges also contribute. And we have a 25 state and county match as well. And yes, those are our funding sources. And we do receive also funding through the federal courthouse as well.
So you're receiving multiple funding streams for your program, including federal dollars, state dollars in from the bar, from the Multnomah County bar.
Yes. And we just opened a second site at the East County Courthouse as well.
So, yes, Representative Sanchez has a question.
Well, not really a question, more of a statement. I think when VOA originally started, it was just one funding source, and I think you've built from there. So let me just say, we have been, I hate to use the word spoiled in a way, but so extremely fortunate to have this program available to our courts in Multnomah County. And I think because it started really relatively small, but the ability to build on that and make that happen for the, you know, folks who are having to access the court system in Multnomah County has just been amazing. And VOA has done a wonderful job doing that, and it's a great opportunity, I think.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If I could just add on the funding point, that certainly we've been diligent in trying to access the alternative streams of funding as well in Marion and Polk. And we've had some success, but it would take a long time for us to get to a turnkey-ready amount of funding without assistance of the legislature. We simply, in these smaller jurisdictions, don't have the same high-powered, we don't have the tall building law firms where you can access significant resources.
Your Honor, has there been any, coming from Marion and representing both Marion and Polk County, have there been much in an appeal to our, whether it is the bar community or other parts of our community? Because I noted that Family Building Blocks is one of them that's here, and that has a robust, actually, support in both Marion and Polk County. So I'm kind of curious as to what efforts have been made, particularly in this county.
We have certainly tried to access the, and I'm not, I don't want to pretend that I'm one of the instrumental people in the fundraising. There are others in the room who could speak more fully to that question. But we certainly have tried hard to access the different resources in the community. We've obtained funding through the Marion County Bar Association. We've obtained funding through the Mid-Willamette Valley Inns of Court at a fundraiser event that was organized through them. The Mary Leonard Law Society, either Oregon Women Lawyers or Mary Leonard had a fundraising event, even just very recently, a few evenings ago. So the fundraising is underway, and it will continue to be underway. It's just a much slower project in Marion Polk than it is in Multnomah. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yes. It's a comment, not a question.
Okay.
Thank you. I would just say, having been a physician with parents bringing small children to appointments, which is stressful enough in and of itself, let alone I can only imagine the atmosphere of a courtroom. I can only imagine what these folks are going through. And I know money's tricky, but I can clearly see, as I think we all can, the benefits. And from my professional experience, I can only imagine it's even more so in a court setting.
Yeah, I would agree. It's just that this community is noted for private-public partnerships, and so my question goes to what is occurring. You know, when I look at, how the initiatives occur in Marion and Polk County, and they have been noted when asked to step forward and to work on initiatives like that. Representative Huffman.
Grant can nod one way or the other. I was thinking that I heard in testimony in early childhood that a little more of the $200,000 is going to go to Polk County because Marion County was a little more sustainable. Did I remember that right, or is it pretty much even split?
Co-chairs, members of the committee, it's actually an even split, but I think perhaps what I didn't do a good enough job in, but it's also in this handout here.
Please state your name for the record.
Brent DeMo again from Polk County. When I mentioned in kind, I think what we need to think about in the building in Polk County, we already have a fully licensed, all of the equipment is bought, Family Building Blocks is already there. They're going to open their doors and allow court care to be a part of that program. In the YMCA program, they already have space designated. The dollars that we're asking for are specifically going to pay for the extra staff to care for families while they do court care. One other significant thing that is worth mentioning in the Polk County model, we're calling it court and community care, and it's actually open to anybody who has an appointment in our building, whether it's the addictions program, behavioral health, mental health, or like I mentioned before, we have a resource center with family resource navigators. When people bring their kids to talk about we're going to be evicted or we don't have enough money to pay the water bill and it's off, we need somewhere for those kids to go to. So it'll be a little bit bigger than just the court care that we talked about. But we do have a much smaller pool to draw from, especially in Polk County. I'm not even sure we have a bar association in Polk County. But we have a building, we have a great partner, and we're in-kinding many of the things that normally you would have to find money for.
And Lisa, I didn't know there's somebody else here that wants to talk. Promise to get them guys to the floor.
All right, so good afternoon, Co-Chair Senator Winters and Representative Stark. Thank you so much for the record. My name is Lisa Harnish, and I'm the Executive Director for the Marion and Polk Early Learning Hub. And I'm here today in support of House Bill 3067, which establishes a court care program in Marion and Polk counties. This will establish the ability to provide a safe and nurturing place for children while parents or their guardians attend court-related businesses in both Marion and Polk counties. In addition, this will allow families who may not otherwise be made aware of or connected with important services that are designated to meet the developmental needs of children to more readily be ready for kindergarten when they arrive, such as, but not limited to, Preschool Promise, Head Start, Early Head Start, Relief Nurseries. Families will also have the opportunity to learn about services or resources designed to help family stability. This is an innovative approach that demonstrates partnership and collaboration in our community. Partners have come together to identify a need and have a real strong desire to minimize this trauma to children while adults deal with the issues that they have with the court system. We really owe it to our children to be as free as possible from these stressors where they have no voice or they have no choice. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you. Since there's no anyone else would like to testify that didn't give it an opportunity to testify. Thank you. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3067. And if you've got anything for the good of the order, John?
I believe so. I think you have DPSST tomorrow.
Tomorrow we have DPSST, and I promised I was going to get you out on time so that you could get to the floor. So if there's no further questions, comments, we are adjourned.